Edgar Wright, thank you so much for joining us on Pitch House Podcast today. Great to have you back on the show. Second time this year.
I know. It amazes me too. It was the first time I've ever successfully multitasked in my life.
I remember, I think it was with Quiet Place 2, I saw the Last Night in Soho trailer for the first time on the big screen. And it really did feel like quite a special event.
Last night, I saw something in my dreams. There was a girl.
And you are?
Sandy.
I know you're a big cinema goer yourself. What's it been like every time you go seeing Last Night in Soho before other people's films?
It's good, actually. I saw it in front of Quiet Place as well. And then I saw it the other day in front of Bond.
Oh, wow.
Which was exciting. So, yeah, I mean, it's always kind of a thrill seeing your own trailer, like, in front of a movie. I mean, I guess hopefully, like, with this one, it stands out as well. I think sort of when I saw it in front of Quiet Place, it was jammed in between all the other horror films that were coming out, and they're always sort of so, they always seem like the other trailers have the same sound mix. They're very aggressive, like, sort of. So it was nice. I mean, I'm really, like, listen, it's been, as you well know, I've been such a sort of, like, journey for cinemas to sort of get back to having full houses again. And I've done my bit to support as much as I can, even just down to going to see films myself as a punter. So for people to be able to see this on the big screen was so important to us. It was one of the reasons that we pushed the film back, like at this, like Christmas last year, when we finished the movie, it was originally scheduled to come out in April. And obviously, as you know, cinemas weren't open in April. So we sat around and we said, we should just push it back into the autumn because, number one, it feels like an autumn movie. I mean, I don't know if you agree with that, but it doesn't feel like a spring or summer movie. It feels like it should come out when the nights are getting colder. So I was very happy to go back to October and it to come out around Halloween. And it meant, you know, we could do all the festivals as well. So I was behind, I got these emails from people saying, oh, you must be so gutted it pushed. I was like, no, I was the one who suggested it.
I fully agree with that. I mean, just even down to the visuals, you know, the neons and the, you know, a lot of the film takes place at night. It makes total sense to release it at this time of year. I think it was a very good move.
There's also, if you see it in Pitch House Central, stay in your seats during the end credits because you'll see the street literally outside the cinema at one point.
I jumped out my seat when I saw that. That was an amazing end credit sequence, I have to say. Such a nice touch. I'm so glad you put that in there.
That was all shot in lockdown, like just before, in like maybe July 2020, just before they reopened outdoor restaurants and stuff. You know, when London was in full lockdown, we went out and shot all of those shots in one night. And it was one of the most magical, spookiest shoots. I'll never forget it because just walking around an empty London with no cars and no pedestrians was just really, really surreal.
Yeah, that's amazing to capture that. I would have loved to have come in to town on some of those days just to see the empty streets, get that 28 days later vibe.
Well, I live in central London now, so I was seeing it every day. It was very, I guess I started to feel like I was literally Sean in London at several points.
I was going to ask about just actually filming in Soho. I was really impressed you shot so much of this on location, and it's such a big film, you know, in terms of taking place in a different time period and lots of cast and some quite complex things. What was it like shooting around town in a, you know, busy heart of London?
It was ambitious for sure. It's probably the most ambitious thing about the production, and certainly the first meetings that we had about the movie were with our location manager, Camilla Stevenson, because I didn't want to fake the Soho scenes elsewhere. So we did actually, everything is shot where it's supposed to be. You know, it's in Soho and Fitzrovia, there's a little bit in Bloomsbury, but it's not like they're supposed to be elsewhere. It's like Eloise lives in Fitzrovia in the movie, she works in Soho, all of the 60 scenes are in Soho. And obviously, you know, they keep coming back to Soho because that's the heart of the story. So I just didn't want to shoot anywhere where it wasn't supposed to be, which was great because, you know, sometimes when you know, films that are shot in London sort of end up faking it in neighborhoods that are easier to shoot in. I think, you know, with other period films like Judy or Legend, they tend to shoot in East London, or sometimes, you know, you shoot in other movies, they shoot kind of in Liverpool or Manchester to kind of double for period London. But we wanted to shoot, we wanted to grab the bull by the horns and make it really difficult for ourselves and shoot Soho for Soho. And for the modern day scenes and the 60s scenes, in fact, one of the two of the shots that I'm most proud of are the ones where we shot 60s London in the heart of London. There's the first shot where Thomas and Mackenzie goes into the 60s and walks across the Haymarket and into the Café de Paris, which is actually the Empire on, it's now called the Empire, confusingly, on Haymarket. The actual Café de Paris is around the corner next to like a casino that used to be a cinema called the Rialto. But we actually, it was easier for us to shoot on Haymarket than the actual Café de Paris. And then the other shot that I'm really proud of is where Anya Taylor-Joy and Matt Smith are driving up Frith Street, right in the middle of Soho, and turn a corner into Bankman Street and go down to Greet Street, all in one shot, all with like 60s dressing across the streets. And I think if you look at Instagram from like somewhere mid-July 2019, tons and tons of people took pictures of the set, not really understanding what was happening. So we really shot those things for real. And it's like, you know, the finished shots have some digital trickery going on in the far distance, like, you know, changing like modern stuff on rooftops and in the far distance, taking out modern buses and replacing them with period ones. But what you're actually seeing on the ground is all real. Period cars, period extras, our amazing production design team changing all of the ground floor shops and bars and creating kind of clubs that didn't exist. So the Rialto Club that we created at the end of on the corner of Bateman Street and Greek Street was, you know, kind of our set built on top of what was actually there.
Oh, wow. That's incredible. Such a huge feat. Our office is very close to Haymarket, and it must have been the morning after you were shooting, the sort of entering the Café de Paris scene. I saw the huge Thunderball billboard, which was up outside the Empire. And I was like, are Empire Cinemas doing some sort of Thunderball revival? Is there an anniversary I'm not aware of? Like, what's going on? And then I saw the panel exams and everything else and sort of put two and two together. But I don't think at that point I knew it was for Last Night in Soho until the trailer came out. So that was quite a reveal for me personally, because I was really wondering why Thunderball was on that cinema.
Wanted to go and see it, I bet. Some people did try and buy tickets for Thunderball because they were like, oh, is Thunderball showing? I'd love to see Thunderball on the big screen.
How did you settle on Thunderball? You had a lot of classic 60s films to choose from, I suppose.
I guess it's funny, I wavered between Thunderball and Fantastic Voyage, and then I eventually settled on Thunderball because I think a lot of people like they could tell what year it was by a James Bond movie. So I guess it was by putting Thunderball on there, we're saying 1965. So actually the other posters that are outside the cinema, you see like Darling, Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, a Judy Dench film called Four in the Morning, which are all 1965 films. So it was just our way of like telling people what year it was. It's also something as well, I mean, it's weird that sort of not completely by design, but there are like three or four Bond references in the movie in a way, because you've got Thunderball. Then there's also a scene where they order a Vespa, you know, in the Café de Paris, which is obviously the cocktail coined by Ian Fleming in Casino Royale, the real name for Bond's cocktail, named after the dead Vespa Lind. Spoiler alert, sorry, spoiling the end of Casino Royale. And then Diana Rigg is obviously in Honor Majesty's Secret Service. And then also Margaret Nolan, who appears in the film briefly in the basement club scene playing the barmaid. She was in Goldfinger playing Dink, but is also, even more famously, the body in the opening credits of Goldfinger, and also the body on the poster is Margaret Nolan, who also sadly is no longer with us. Both Diana and Margaret have both sadly passed away. So it was amazing to have all these connections back to sort of 60s cinema, and the sort of four Bond connections was somewhat, I mean, the only one that we wrote into the script was the Vespa one. That was written into the script. The other ones are sort of subtle by chance.
And then you got to see the trailer in front of No Time to Die. So it was all meant to be.
I know.
I wanted to ask sort of what was the beginning of the story? You know, what was your first idea for the story for this film, and how did it develop as you started to write with Christy Wilson Cairns?
I mean, I had the story worked out for quite a long time before I even met Christy. I'd been thinking about it for over a decade. And then the first time I mentioned it out loud was to Naira Park, my longtime producer. And then I started developing it there, first with Film 4 when Tessa Ross was still there, because I remember before The World's End, I remember going to meet Tessa and pitching her the idea. And so the first thing, and so where it kind of came from essentially is like a couple of things. Is like, I guess a strange obsession with the 60s. I say strange because I was born in 1974. So there's a point when you're obsessing about a decade that you never lived in that you have to wonder why that is. And is even the thing about nostalgia or being kind of so afflicted with nostalgia a failure to deal with the present day? If you're daydreaming that much about going back to 60s London, which I do, what does that really mean? Is it like something where you're just retreating from modern life itself? And what does that say? Is it like that that's kind of what the point of the movie is are you retreating back into the past because you think things were better then? You know, that the reality of it is everything that's bad now was just as bad then, maybe even worse in some respects. And so there's that element to it. And then I guess also just having lived in London for 27 years, I think I've spent more time in Soho than any sofa in any flat that I've ever lived in. And that's because it's a place to socialize, like cinemas, theaters, comedy, music, restaurants, bars. It's the center of the film and TV industry. So every movie, and even stretching back to the TV shows I used to do, have always been edited in Soho. So I just spent an enormous amount of time there late at night. And I know what that experience is like as a man on his own. And obviously through Christy and others, I know what that experience is like as a woman as well, that Soho is one of those places that can be very fun and be somewhere that's kind of like, always an interesting adventure. And then after midnight, the energy changes. And I think sort of after midnight is when Soho starts to revert more to what it used to be like. And it always feels like it's a place that's like, that danger is always just, or rather like a very bad decision is only 30 seconds away. So it's interesting because I feel like it's a sort of neighborhood that sort of seems slightly like a law unto itself. That you feel like when you go inside that square mile, that it definitely feels different from any other part of London. And it's been compelling to like artists and writers for hundreds of years for that reason. And then on top of that, I'm the kind of person that thinks about the ghosts of the past a lot and literally thinks when I'm in an old building, who has lived and died in this room and what has happened in this room? What did this room used to be? And because the buildings in Soho are hundreds of years old, you just get the sense that there is like so much history and energy in the room of what has happened here.
I think there's a line in the film, maybe from Diana Rigg, where she says, you know, lots of people have died in this room. And I was like, oh God, that's like every flat I've lived in.
Well, she said, this is London. Someone's died in every room and every building in this whole city and every street corner too. And I believe that. I really believe that. I feel like if you're in a building in London that's hundreds of years old, of course somebody's died in that building. And what do they leave behind? I mean, there's two ways of looking at ghosts. And my mum is the kind of person, very much like Eloise, who is very supernaturally switched on in terms of that she will feel presences, and she has sometimes seen ghosts. And in my family house, we grew up in Somerset, she saw two different ghosts from two different generations of inhabitants. Now, you could say, some people think that ghosts are like souls that are left behind on earth in purgatory that cannot ascend to heaven or hell because they have unfinished business. And then the other theory, which is kind of what we're talking about, is like, what is the psychic energy left behind by an event? Like, so if you're in a room where a murder has happened, is something left behind by that event? I would say yes. you know, and I don't have any scientific basis. But I believe that idea of good and bad energy. And there's another line in the film where Pauline McLean playing Carol in the landlady in the toucan, you know, she's asked about spirits and she sort of says that the pub, she thinks if it's haunted by anything, it's the good times and she can feel the good vibes or something. So I believe that idea of like good and bad energies that are left behind by previous inhabitants.
I think it's it really makes you think as an audience member, and yeah, it's great, as you know, it's great for storytelling, a great like jumping off point for really delving into, you know, where this film goes for sure.
There was an enormous like phone book tome of research done by the amazing Lucy Pardy before we wrote a word of the script, and I was rereading it again the other day, and I just thought, oh my god, there's like 100 stories in here. I was just like, I feel that's the thing. In a strange way, like with this movie, is even though I've made it and it's coming out, I feel anything like slightly sad at the idea. It's like kind of like a child leaving home, and it's like I won't know what to do when it's out because I'm not making it anymore. And it's something that I feel like it's sort of it's I won't even say it's necessarily like an enjoyment thing of making it. Of course, it was enjoyable making the film, but there's also a point where a film is like haunting you. And in this particular case, it's like I still like live in the area. So I go past the locations of the movie every day. So I feel that there's a point where I kind of like, I guess the movie actually coming out in cinemas should be some form of exorcism for me, but perhaps not.
It'd be a healthy release to let it go to college. I was really excited to hear that you were working with Chung Hoon Chung on this film. You know, love so many of those previous films, especially, you know, things like The Handmaiden and stuff that came out before. I'd love to know how that collaboration happened. You know, is he someone you've wanted to work with for a while?
Well, the amazing thing is it happened very late in the day and it couldn't have been a more perfect fit. Basically, Bill Pope, who is my regular DP of the last three movies, was suddenly had to kind of drop out of the film for kind of like reasons beyond his control and ours. So maybe about 8 weeks before shooting, we had to find a new DP. And Chung Chung Hoon was available. And as soon as his name came up, me and Naira both thought, ooh, Chung Chung Hoon, DP of Old Boy and Lady Vengeance and Stoker and, you know, The Handmaiden, you know, that sounds interesting. And actually, one of my good friends, actually, when I live in LA, sometimes I live next door to him, Alfonso Gomez Rejon, had done two films with Chung, Me and Earl and the Dying Girl and The Current War. So he was like the first person I called. And he said, he goes, oh my God, you and Chung working together? That would be amazing. You guys would get on so great. And he says, you got to hire him. So, I mean, I didn't really need any, you don't really need to get references for somebody like Chung, but I just wanted to see what he was like as a person. And then he came to the movie straight off another movie, flew to London, and I can't remember. He didn't have, I mean, maybe he was with us for less than 6 weeks before we started shooting. I mean, it feels like when you watch the film that I designed the entire thing with him in mind, but it's not the case. What is amazing is that when he read the script, he looked at all the storyboards and he said, he goes, oh, you know, Director Park storyboards everything. So, you know, your storyboards remind me of Director Park. Because I guess like Park Chan-wook does a similar thing to me where I tend to sort of draw out the entire movie, you know, first me doing rough sketches and then an army of amazing, talented storyboard artists kind of finish them off, including my brother, actually. But really, that's kind of like a roadmap, is that I like to draw the whole thing out because even if things change, it's still like a map to where we're going with this and helpful for the crew. And then just sort of just what Chung brought to it is that I think there's something that's in a lot of the films he did with Park Chan-wook. They have this kind of dark opulence about them that they're obviously The Handmaiden has that, but even in Old Boy, which is a film that is incredibly gritty in parts, it still kind of like looks ravishing at the same time. And so the idea of him coming on board to watch the movie was great. And we watched a couple of, I had this that mood reel that I put together, which can never exist on any Blu-ray because we never clear all the clips. But the first thing I did was cut together this mood reel with our assistant editor, Jerry, and I showed that to him. And then we watched a couple of movies to get in the mood. I think we watched like Carol, Todd Haynes' movie. I know that wouldn't seem like the obvious one to watch for this, but there was a point where we were thinking about shooting it in 16 mil, which then we abandoned and we shot it in 35 mil instead. And Repulsion we watched, and also Clute, which is a great one to watch on the big screen. Like, the photography in that film is just exquisite. Gordon Willis's photography. But, you know, but Chung is just amazing because he... The thing that I wasn't expecting from Chung Chung-hoon was I wasn't expecting how funny he was going to be. And given that most of the films he makes are incredibly dark, it sort of makes sense in a way that the one of the things that got me through a very, you know, taxing, mentally and physically taxing shoot was having this real goofball who would be able to make me laugh all the time, which on a very stressful shoot sometimes is really something. So I want to thank Chung for keeping me smiling. He's just, what a joy to work with. And like, I just saw him the other day for the first time in a year in person. It's just like a delight to be around, and I hope I get to work with him again.
I think audiences would love that too. The film is visually very complex and a joy to watch on a big screen. And I think you know, the way Chung captures it is so good. Thanks so much for your time today, Edgar. Really, really looking forward to playing Last Night in Soho in our cinemas across the country at the end of the month. Perfect film to see on the big screen. And it was the perfect time of year to see it. That move was the right call.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Well, I hope everybody enjoys it, and I hope to see you all soon.